Good evening and welcome to Left, Right and Center. I'm Vishnu Shom, coming to you live from Munich. It's over here that the Munich Security Conference is taking place at a profound time when it comes to the security of the world. Just a day after the United States read Europe the riot act, saying that they may not indefinitely participate in the security of Europe, comes a fairly strong response from Europe itself, with the Germans say it's not just about one country, it's about collective security. With British leaders who are also attending, making the point that it has to be Europe coming together, if necessary, by raising their GDP percentage in their defense budgets to more than 2.5% to ensure that there is a European army which can potentially take on the threat of Russia. If you were thinking or wondering whether this is a return to the Cold War, then some would suggest that perhaps that is exactly the situation, the scenario that we are looking at. Now, why are we talking about this? We are talking about this because just a couple of days back, the US President Donald Trump made it clear, in a sense, read Volodymyr Zelensky the riot act by saying that, look, the war has to come to an end. There's been a huge loss of life. Do not expect the United States to indefinitely be fueling the war effort by Ukraine. He's also reached out to the Russian President Vladimir Putin. And in that conversation, he's also said that, look, it is time to end that war. And he said that both sides were positive. This message was then conveyed to Mr. Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, who appears to be saying that, yes, we need to have peace, but there need to be robust security guarantees for Ukraine. Is this plan really something which has been thought through? What exactly are the contours that it's going to take? Well, that's what we're going to talk about on this program. But first, a quick look at a couple of the important statements made by the Ukrainian leader here in Munich a little while back.
We really want peace and we work on it. We will prepare security guarantees like we see. We will share it with the United States and I hope they will share their view. As I said, common view for me is very important to hear all our partners in Europe who helped us, in EU plus, of course, because UK, our partners, big partners, and that's why it's very important to prepare during months all these things, to share it with the President of the United States, to find time for this, to our common meetings, to make this common plan, then to put it on the table for Putin and do everything. That things what really President Trump, he's strong, he can do, put sanctions or pressure in any ways, in any case, how he wants. And after that, to stop this war this year, 2025, make a peace in Ukraine. This is our plan. That's what we really want, and that's what we will try to do. I'm focusing on surviving of our country, and I'm doing really all my term. Half of my term was COVID. Another half is the war with Putin or against him. Yes? So this is what really very important. I'm ready, you know, to speak about elections if you want. Ukrainians don't want, totally don't want, because they afraid, because otherwise we will lose the military law, war law, and our soldiers will come back home and Putin will occupy all our territory. It will be, because now we are mobilized, now we are one organism, yes, so we are one country. Yeah, that's why it's very important to hold and to save it. And it doesn't matter, I mean, this, we need unity in country. So it's not about, you know, myself. It's about the future of our country. It's about, for today, really, the question is to survive. The question is to save Ukraine, our independence, our people, our homes. And if somebody doesn't like, they can choose another citizenship.
Well, on this program, we are going to be bringing in specialists from the United States, from Ukraine and from Russia as well, to give us their expert views on what's taking place over here. I'm now joined by Glenn Kahl. He's been a career CIA officer, and I've had the opportunity of speaking to him over the last several years on several occasions about the Russia-Ukraine war. Glenn Kahl, thanks very much for being with us. Yesterday, the United States essentially read Europe the riot act, with J.D. Vance, the vice president, making the point that, look, there's been a rollback of basic freedoms in Europe, and that it's those freedoms which have defined what NATO has been all about. There's a sense of disbelief, of shock over here in Europe. But is this a prelude to America reassessing the basis of its relationship with Europe?
Well, I wouldn't put that in the future tense. Controlling faction of the Republican Party and Donald Trump and J.D. Vance have been pretty clear that that's what they have done, are doing, and will do, yes. Now, where does that come from? The Republican Party and a broad section of American society for 150 years has had a strong current of isolationism. Donald Trump combines two things to the extent that he has views. And one is his family's heritage, frankly, it combines German fascistic views with American isolationist views. Now, one should recall that ancient history is not irrelevant here. Yeah. The America First movement identified strongly with Nazi fascist Germany, and that aligned with American isolationism. So he is sincere. J.D. Vance, the vice president, and Donald Trump are sincere to the extent they have political views that they don't feel the United States should support Europe in any ways. And the ideology, individual rights, democracy are frankly irrelevant to them.
But Mr. Carl, you know, so many years, more than 2 years after the war began, and after hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives on either side, in Russia and in Ukraine, isn't it terribly disappointing that we don't seem to be any closer to a peace plan? Because A, the Ukrainians are resisting, and B, because the European nations are resisting as well. They say that there is nothing robust which has emerged in terms of a plan. It almost seems as if they want this to continue for the foreseeable future. Isn't that disappointing?
No, it's not disappointing necessarily. It's disappointing if peace is the ultimate only objective that overrides everything else. But if there are alternatives to peace that are worse than peace, then one has to continue fighting. Some things, many people believe that there are certain beliefs and ways of life that are worth fighting and, if necessary, dying for. The license plates for automobiles to the state north of where I live says live free or die. That was one of the slogans of the American Revolutionary War. Many people believe that. The Ukrainians do not want to be extinguished as a culture and as a people. And so they believe that it is worth fighting to the death for. Many Europeans believe that too. America has believed that up until now. So peace is not necessarily the only objective that one should put above all others. And Zelensky makes the clear case that that is not the situation.
Mr. Carl, in terms of you know, the potential contours, Pete Hegseth, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, had laid down you know, some of the potential contours of any peace agreement. Now, it's not as if the Ukrainians have accepted that. It's not as if the Russians would necessarily accept a lot of that either. But what he did say is important. He said that, look, there can be no return to the 2014, the pre-2014 boundaries of Ukraine, number one. Number two, there is no question of Ukraine's membership in NATO. And number three, there won't be American boots on the ground in any peacekeeping mission. Do you not believe that realistically, this is what, you know, any peace agreement, any peace arrangement would ultimately end up being?
Well, it's most likely that a peace agreement will, officialize the state of play on the ground. And, you know, it's Stalin who pointed out that you know, diplomacy extends to the end of the rifle, or some phrase similar to that. And it's a fact that Russia now occupies 20% of Ukraine, and Ukraine without an increase in aid from NATO and the United States cannot push them out. But it's also true that Russia does not have the strength, given the current balance of forces, to impose its will entirely either. They are buying several meters of ground per day at the cost of 1,500 lives per week. And their economy is struggling in ways that they have successfully parried so far, but also masked. So the conditions for a peace negotiation to work is that all parties have to be willing to engage in them. So far, Russia has not been willing. Under the duress of the Trump election, Ukraine has expressed a willingness to, recognizing reality that U.S. aid might cease. But without some sticks to pressure, to induce Russia to see more benefit in negotiation than not, then a negotiation is really unlikely, because Putin is willing to accept 1,500 deaths and wounded per week. The stick would be, and Trump has alluded to this, really only the only stick, and it's a substantial one, would be increased U.S. aid to Ukraine. Now, Trump, I don't think, will do that, but absent that, there's no particularly convincing inducement or pressure to bring Putin to the table. So not all conditions are yet met for a meaningful peace negotiation.
Right. So, Glencar, lots of interesting points that you mentioned over there. I think what I'll do at this stage, and thank you so much for sharing those, is to listen into a little bit more of what Volodymyr Zelensky said today. Where does he stand? Because he's under pressure from the United States. Very clear, look, this war needs to end. On the other hand, he wants to continue with the aggression against Russia, because it is Russia which has invaded Ukraine, but he can't do that without American assistance either. So it is very difficult at this stage. Lives continue to be lost. But let's listen into what he said.
More strong sanctions, not if they will invade again, just more strong sanctions at the very beginning than for Ukraine and Ukrainian soldiers. That's why we need big army. I shared it yesterday. Yes, we need army more than now. If we're not in NATO, then, as I said, NATO has to be in Ukraine. It means only one, that we will need the army comparable with soldiers of Russia. It's 1.3 or 1.5 million soldiers. So we need money for this, the package of money, real money. And it's big deficit. Even today, for us, it's 40 billion per year. So this money, and then weapon, and the package of missiles, what was written in the victory plan, the package which we will not use, but it has to stand on our territory.
Now from Kiev, Dr. Mridula Ghosh, she's an associate professor at the National University of Kiev. Experts, you know, of the entire region. She's lived in Ukraine for many, many years. Dr. Ghosh, great to speak to you once again. Is there changing public opinion in Ukraine to end the war? I ask this because on the three odd occasions that I have covered the war, you know, it seemed that the Ukrainian people were entirely defiant and that there was no mood to bring this to an end. They wanted to end the Russian aggression. Is that changing?
Oh, people want peace. I think more than Ukrainians, nobody else needs peace today. Even as I'm talking to you, I have to interrupt if a siren sounds. So the aggression continues 24/7. I need to mention, peace is needed, but what kind of peace? That is the most important question every Ukrainian is asking. And what kind of peace, what kind of agreement? Will it be another Budapest memorandum that will be just violated? Will it be another Minsk, which will not be fulfilled, so, and which will be running counter to Ukraine's national interests? And Ukraine being, you know, suffered the aggression, that's one of the points that people are not ready to accept. However, they are decent to understand that their limitations, they understand the you know, that aid cannot continue forever, but they also understand that, you know, there cannot be an easy solution like a 24-hour stop to the war. It will take more time. And also, if Ukraine has to come to a compromise, then Russia also has to come to a compromise. It cannot be on only Russia's terms. As of now, it stands that all of the propositions, even advanced by the U.S. side, has been somehow kowtowing the Moscow line, whatever arguments Russia has produced. So that is something that will not be effective. And I believe more than Ukraine, the Europeans also need to be on board. The main thing is nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine, nothing about Europe without Europe. This is the point.
That's the statement by the foreign minister today, who actually made the point that, look, it's all very well for America to be talking about itself and its interests, but what about the interests of a collective Europe? But the fact of the matter is that Europe cannot industrially match perhaps what is required for Ukraine to indefinitely sustain this war effort. And I don't think Ukraine can sustain the loss of flying presently. Perhaps Russia can for some more time. This being the case, isn't the peace solution the only realistic way forward, as uncomfortable as for Ukraine at this stage?
I did not hear you clearly, but as I understand, that peace is important. But again, Ukraine needs secured guarantees to that peace. What will be the kind of guarantees more important than whatever peace is on the table? And of course, it cannot be a bilateral talk between the United States and Russia, because, you know, and deciding the fate of Ukraine, that cannot take place. Ukraine needs to be on board, and also Europe. That is the point now made. And of course, if it is multilateral, and Ukraine have already started peace negotiations a year ago, even more than a year ago, it had made the 10-point peace plan. It had organized several meetings, including a summit in Switzerland. I think then, you know, there were no other country doing this kind of activity. So that needs to be honored as well.
All right, Professor Ghosh, thank you very much, you know, for sharing those perspectives. We're going to move on now to our other guest as well. I'm now joined by Tatiana. She's a journalist. She joins me from Russia. Thank you, Tatiana, very much for being with us. You know, there was that very dramatic announcement by the U.S. president. There were signs that the Kremlin was also willing to take forward this process of peace talks and peace dialogue. But 2 days later, are you somewhat disappointed that the momentum that seemed to have picked up, you know, hasn't really transpired into anything substantive?
The project will strengthen the energy security of not just Ukraine, but our entire region of Europe. And we also recently spoke with President Trump and his team about nuclear energy and Europe's largest nuclear power plant, our Zaporizhzhia plant, which is currently occupied by Russia. And Russia responded by sending a drone to hit Chernobyl's sarcophagus, which holds radioactive dust and debris. And this is not just madness. This is Russia's stance. A country that launches such attacks does not want peace. Not. They don't want. It is not preparing for dialogue. Look at what Putin is trying to do now. This is his game. Putin wants one-on-one talks with America, just like before the war, when they met in Switzerland and looked like to carve up the world. Next, Putin will try to get the U.S. president standing on Red Square on May 9th this year, not as a respected leader, but as a prop in his own performance. We don't need that. We need real success. We need real peace. And I do not believe in security guarantees without America. Yes, it will be just weak, but America will not offer guarantees unless Europe's own guarantees are strong. And I also will not take NATO membership for Ukraine off the table. But right now, the most influential member of NATO seems to be Putin. Because his whims have the power to block NATO decisions.
Tatiana Kukureva, senior journalist from Russia. Thank you, Tatiana, very much for being with us. You know, there was a sense of optimism a couple of days back after that conversation between Donald Trump and President Putin. Are you somewhat disappointed that there hasn't been progress over here in Munich towards a peace agreement?
No, Vishnu, you know what? Not at all, because I don't believe that we spoke, you know, just after that conversation. And I told you we need to kind of take it one step at a time. I don't believe that the Munich conference was the place to make any further progress. You know, Donald Trump makes the statements, and then we need to understand that Europe needs to react to them. And I believe that everybody in Europe is, you know, very much in reactionary mode right now. We just listened to Mr. Zelensky. He's gone through several stages, you know, of grief so far. Now, this one is clearly anger and denial. And we need to still have time to go to acceptance. You can hear him again saying, we want peace, but we will not take NATO membership off the table. So we do want peace, but we want peace with conditions. He is a very good public speaker. You have to give him that. This has been his forte all along. But if you listen closely to what he's saying that Ukraine, A, does not want peace the way that Donald Trump has made it clear that he's looking for to make it happen. He is kind of associating himself to Europe because even after J.D. Vance's speech, we've already heard such a huge wave of indignation, specifically coming from the UK, where all of the liberal outlets, all of the left-wing outlets have been pouring poison all over that speech. Is it difficult to hear the truth? You know, they're calling it populism. And he's playing on this divide, and he's going to continue playing on this divide. He's not ready to accept that the American cash flow is going to end.
So that being the case, Tatiana, what is the way forward? Europe may be in denial. Ukraine may be unclear. But I think Ukraine knows that without American support, the war effort cannot be sustained. America is not going to do that indefinitely. Now, forget about what's happening over here in Munich. Do you expect, you know, more conversations between Putin and Trump to perhaps bypass the sentiment in Europe right now and push for a peace settlement?
I expect more conversations specifically between Moscow and Washington. First of all, President Putin has made it very, very clear, abundantly clear, that we do consider the US to be our main counterpart in this debate. And it is very, you know, it is very logical in the sense when the previous administration had been bankrolling this conflict for almost three years now. And even before that, when we saw, you know, millions worth of lethal aid pouring into Ukraine, and the extremely hypocritical anti-terrorist operation happening in Donbass. So I do believe that this will be coming down to conversations between the US and Russia. And I think that Europe will probably have to be forced into some sort of understanding. Ukraine, Zelensky will bargain every single chip that he has, because you heard him. He says Ukraine does not need elections because we're mobilized.
All right. The other aspect of what the U.S. vice president said yesterday, which is really what's shocked people over here, is that there's been a rollback of freedoms in Europe. And that the very premise of NATO, you know, seems to be challenged at this juncture, of unity between Europe and America. How does Russia see these remarks? It must be I mean, good news from a Russian perspective that you've got America saying these things.
Well, you know, the question in itself kind of suggests that we would like to see Europe in disarray, doesn't it, Vishnu? Which is not the case. You know, the most heartbreaking thing...
I must admit, that's true.
The most heartbreaking thing for me as a journalist who has worked in Europe, who, you know, has been traveling to Europe for years and... you know, it was the fact that it was so easy to unite Europe against Russia, whereas we've had billions worth of trade agreements. We've had successful businesses, and it was just so easy to utilize and use it as an arm, really. One simple idea, you know. That the fear of you know, post-Soviet kind of reflexia is still so strong that it was so easy to mobilize Europe against Russia, whereas we've been saying from the very beginning there is no way, you know, no world in which we want to go anywhere, really. You know, we just want for the killing to stop killing Russian people, stop threatening us with NATO. Just stop. So there's not been any sign of any even hint of an aggression towards Europe, and yet all of the European left-wing populists are going to continue. They have been, and they're going to continue using this idea of this big, terrible Russia to create further discord and further division. And the problem with, you know, what Mr. Vance said yesterday, it actually rang very true, again, for me as a journalist who's seen things changing. We've been watching European right wing gaining strength throughout the years. I was looking at it back in 2017 before, you know, before COVID, in another life, basically. And they've been refusing this, they've been denying this. And the right wing in Europe... It's not even the, they vilify it, they put it out to be a disease, but that's a symptom. That's a symptom of the fact that the people have been losing quality of life.
All right, Tatiana, I'm interrupting because I'm completely out of time on this program. The Ukrainian perspective, of course, very different. It was Russia that invaded Ukraine. There was a regime change which was planned. That didn't work out. I don't want to get into all of that other than the fact that, you know, the loss of life has been staggering on either side. And for those of us who were hopeful of a peace this time around, I hot-footed it from New Delhi to Munich after Trump's tweet in the hope that something major would be announced over here. It is deeply saddening to see that at the moment there doesn't appear to be much progress. Perhaps there may be changes or there may be something substantive on the sidelines of Munich. We'll have to wait and see. But for the moment, the war continues.